All right, thank you. Martin gave me a task to present the lattice QCD perspective on the structure of the nucleon. And obviously, we want to know a lot about the nucleons, protons and neutrons, because they're one of our primary probes, both in the high-energy experiments and in the low-energy precision experiments. And understanding how quarks and gluons move inside them precisely is very important for the new frontiers in physics. So this is a very sketchy outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'll show just two slides about the lattice QCD. I presume most of the people know what it is about and challenges that we face. Then I'll spend, I think it's a good idea to give a sort of perspective on where we are in understanding and computing various aspects of nucleon structure, such as form factors, for example, the primary things we want to know about the nucleons, like distributions of charge and magnetization and axial charge density, so to speak. Because the main topic of the meeting, as far as I understand, is the nuclear physics and in the context of fundamental symmetries, I'll give an example of our recent work, how lattice QCD can influence, program of searching for neutron, anti-neutron oscillations. And if I have time, I'll also say a few words about the quark momentum and spin inside the proton. All right, so lattice QCD, as you know, is a first principles calculation from QCD. We directly evaluate the path integral of the theory, integrating over quarks and gluons, and integral over quarks is analytic. It gives us determinant in the Monte Carlo weight in the integral that we use then to generate ensemble of fields in which we then solve basically quark equations of motion. And these quark equations of motions here are represented by quark lines that we have to, the quark and the quark pairs are contracted into these sort of lines. And primarily we'll be talking about hadron matrix elements, proton matrix elements to be specific, and neutron. And the main way to do this at the moment is to compute three-point functions. So we have a creation operator, operator insertion, and annihilation operator, which we separate in Euclidean time. And we let them, the state that we created in the lattice, we let it propagate for a while in Euclidean time so that the excited states decay, we hope so. Then we put an operator that we want to measure, and again, some extent of time to kill the excited states, and in the end we hope to end up with the ground state matrix elements only. And of course we should expect that excited states, if we are not careful, will contribute to our measurement and will bias our results. So it's important to notice that there are two types of diagrams on the lattice. There is a connected and disconnected ones. So disconnected ones are more difficult to calculate because, you know, the type of the contraction basically tells us that we have to sum over these points over the entire lattice and solve the direct equation for every point on the lattice.
Can you quantify the errors coming from excited states on the ground state?
Well, the most primitive way is to just increase the sourcing separation, well, these two times, independently, preferably, and then see how the result changes and then see some convergence. But the problem is that the noise also increases. So that's sort of the other barrier, the other challenge.
The Monte Carlo weight, it's defined by Gerwonnik reaction, right? So in this way, there is a kind of effective change of reaction due to Fermion integration, which includes in particular this disconnected diagram, right? But it's not the procedural counts as well for the change of the action due to Fermions, right?
Well,
Monte Carlo is still based, this ensemble is based still on Gerwonnik reaction.
No, it's going to be full.
It's full dynamical. This determinant is.
No, not the right. The determinant is there, right? But when you calculate the probabilities, those probabilities of the configuration does include the.
Yes, that's the probability.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Yeah.
And then we don't have to recompute this determinant with every observable and average over it. Otherwise, the important sampling wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And the difference between quenched and unquenched is that you look at this operator on in quenched calculations and looked at the spectrum, then you will see the completely different spectrum.
But you can compare, say, quenched and your unquenched. When you're calculating the semantic element, you can do it in quenched approximation as well.
Right, yeah, but the state of the art is that we can now afford to do unquenched. Mm-hmm. So we don't care about quenched anymore.
Uh-huh.
Right, so to recover the physics, we have to take the large volume limit, the small lattice spacing limit, and also set the parameters to the physical, the quark masses to the physical values, specifically the light quark masses. And here comes here come the challenges. The first one and most obvious one is that the noise increases rapidly, and the noise is determined by the lattice degree of freedom, which is pi n. And if you look at the quark propagator, just the norm, how it increases decreases with the distance, it just decays with the half of the pi n mass, because the square of d slash is the pi n propagator. And for n quarks, if you have, let's say, n valence quarks, then you have appropriate factor here. And you can imagine that then if you want to build from this propagator something useful with the quantum numbers of the proton, for example, then there are a lot of cancellations. And these cancellations have to win when you average over a lot of statistics. They have to win over this non-canceling things that just decay as in the case of baryon, as 3/2 of the pi mass with time. And this problem becomes worse when you go to lighter pi masses. Then the next problem is that the volume has to be increased. Martin mentioned that a week ago. And typically, it is required that the volume is at least 4 to 6 pi masses, inverse pi masses, depending on what you're looking at, and also depending on what resources you have. So I would say in nuclear structure calculations at the physical point, people tend to hold around this lower boundary of this range, just because, well, we would like to go to larger volumes, but it's very, very expensive still at the physical pi masses. And the third problem is that as pi masses decrease, even if you look at the naive, non-interacting picture, the gap to the first excited state will also decrease. For example, the first excited state for the nucleon would be nucleon pi and a P wave. And then you somehow have to remove that contamination, either by creating smart operators or accumulating huge amount of statistics and increasing the suppressing Euclidean time separation.
But I would think that it something depends what channel you're considering. Say XL current, right? You have vector part, which is like A1 meson or whatever, right? And there is a pseudo-scalar form factor, which is one pi m exchange, right? And of course, one pi m exchange is much more sensitive to mass of pi m, you know, and because it just contains 1 over pi squared, right? So in this way, are you sensitive to, you know, this type of differences?
Well, there are form factors that change with the pi mass, right? Like GP form factor.
But
right?
But I'm trying to say that some form factors are less sensitive, and this form factor is less sensitive than pseudoscalar form factor.
That is very, very
reason,
possible,
right?
Yes. And we, as far as I know, we don't, in the community, it's not widespread. Or actually, I don't know of examples where people constructed.
No, let's say consider pseudoscalar form factors, then you should see 1 m pi squared. Because it's just pi in exchange.
Right, but that'll be the ground state. So if we could somehow construct
the ground state, I mean, form factor of nucleon, right?
But
if you consider matrix element, then it would be 1 m pi squared.
Yeah, absolutely, and we see that. The problem I'm discussing here is that when you have excited states in addition to ground states,
mm-hmm.
it would be nice to have some understanding, whether you know from Carl perturbation theory or elsewhere, how these excited states couple to our operators that we
uh-huh.
somehow create, and that will give us an insight how to create smarter operators, because at the moment. Probably the best idea we have is to construct a basis of variational states, including, for example, quarks with the orbital motion put by hand, And then it creates a matrix, variational matrix for the free-point function, and then we can then diagonalize this matrix. And these calculations, they're quite expensive, just because if you have three operators on the basis, which is not very many, then you have 9 times more expensive calculation.
And these excited states include also the continuum states, right?
So here I show the continuum
states. Exchange, you can view as a nuclear and plus pi state, right?
Yep.
Yeah, but it's in the S channel, right?
With the momentum.
Yeah.
Sorry, with the relative momentum.
It's not exchange. It's just.
But it is like collecting a nuclear pi and vertex, right? Because this enters in the calculation of our factors as well.
Well, there are also off-diagonal things, right? Nucleon plus pi, and if you have an axial current, can go into nucleon. This is what you're talking about, right? Yeah. That these contributions are somewhat easier to combat because if you have an additional pion, for example, here, then you can increase the put operator closer to this operator to the sink and see how it behaves, right? It should die out. But if there is a diagonal excited state contribution, excited state here and excited state here, you have no choice but to increase the total separation, and it's always additional cost in this case.
Yeah. So can you say something about the signal to noise? So obviously it does make a difference, but which interpolating operators reduces the noise, or I guess the noise factor? Make it more compact, does it have a harder time coupling to the three pi state, and therefore the noise reduces?
That's a very good point. Yeah. So there is a the state of the art is that the nucleon QQQ operator is constructed from three quarks, which are what we call smeared. Like have Gaussian shape, coherently constructed Gaussian shape, and you want to do to have enough of this smearing so that it roughly resembles probably the nucleon, but not too much. If you do it too much, then it starts to couple to multi-pion states, in addition to nucleon. And I think Martin mentioned that, right? So you don't want to create too extended distributions of quarks, especially in the case of the nuclei.
This is the whole
problem of the wall.
Well, there are two challenges. You want to suppress excited states, but you don't want to increase the noise.
Yeah, so we'll do some work with Idris on optimizing on overlap onto the correlator and minimizing overlap onto the variance correlator. So it's a multi-dimensional optimization that we can attempt to do.
So I'll go straight to discussing physics that comes out of these calculations. And the first thing to discuss is the vector form factors of the nucleon. They are, probably the first things we ever learned about the structure of the nucleon, and the research continues. So one of the things that are of interest now in particular, we want to see the transition between non-perturbative QCD to the perturbative scaling of the form factors. And there is there are particular predictions for F1 to F2 ratio, and there are indications for some peculiar behavior of the electric to magnetic ratio from JLab. So currently the program is to explore these form factors with the JLab upgrade up to 18 GeV squared. And we hope to be able to do similar things on the lattice within a few years. Another thing that lattice can do fairly reliably almost now is to separate flavor contributions to the form factors. So in experiments, you have to measure proton and neutron separately, or deuteron, and then combine them, rely on the C2 symmetry and such, to extract U and D flavors separately. But on the lattice, they just come up as a core currents, obviously. Another thing about the form factors that's interesting is the proton radius. As we all know, there are two values currently in contradiction with each other, with 7 sigma difference. And there are at least 2 experiments with scattering and other experiments with the spectroscopy to remeasure previous results.
Yeah, are you going to get 5% accuracy on the lattice?
That's the current goal. Yeah, that's what we put in the proposals.
How far off is that?
We have to increase the precision by about factor of 3, what was back in 2012, actually. So I would think we're on the verge of pushing it. It's, well, at least when we talk about statistical error. Systematic error is still, don't really know how much systematic error we'll have to deal with.
But the difference is not that small, right? Not that big, I mean, so in this way it would be indeed very sensitive to your real accuracy, on the lattice. Whether you are able to see this 7 sigma difference or not, right?
Yes.
Well, what we have to do is to compute the value with the precision, with the error bar 3 times smaller than the difference, right? That's the goal.
Yeah.
And but currently we're...
That it is 3 times better in statistical sense, right? It's still not kind of final answer in terms of systematic.
Oh, yeah. It's systematic, especially excited states, as you will see, are quite a bit of a problem. So first, this is the picture of form factors. Published about 2 years ago. This is not a line. This is a band from phenomenological fit to experimental data. Experimental data is not shown here. What is shown is our lattice data points. And you see the overlap is quite nice. This is the proton minus neutron form factor. So both proton and neutron, we have phenomenology fits from experiments, so we just plot one over the other, see very nice agreement. This was a calculation done with almost the physical pion mass, just about 10% above the physical point, which is close enough. Yeah.
Yes, third point is very close by, we're fluctuating quite a lot. These are different lattices, or?
What is fluctuating?
Oh,
these are different kinematics. So you can have different momenta in the source and the sink, in and out stage.
Okay.
And for example, these 3 points are actually almost the same momentum transfer, but because they're both source and sink are boosted, it is slightly different. Q squared.
About the bounds of Q squared. So what bounds of Q squared can you use? Are there transport twisted boundaries that allow you to go low than 2 pi over L?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we can do twisted boundary conditions, and actually I don't remember recent results people did with twisted boundary conditions, but there is a different thing we can do. So just a little, ahead, I'll show that we do twisted boundary conditions, but we expand in twisted angle instead of just fixing the angle. We expand on it, and that way we can get a slope right at zero. I will come to that in a couple of slides. I'll come to that. Yeah, it's the big question. Yeah, exactly. One thing I forgot to mention is that one of the problems with the determination of the radius from scattering, you probably all know that. I just want to mention that again, that it is extracted from some kind of a phenomenological form, shape, right, that you fit to experimental data. And then the extraction of the radius relies basically on the values of the form factor up to 1 GV squared, which is probably not the most sound thing you can do with respect to quantity, which is defined at 0. All right. So the previous slide showed the form factors for proton minus neutron difference. These are the form factors for the proton itself. And it includes the U plus D contributions. No strange flavor. There are only light quarks here. And this, in principle, should include disconnected pieces, but it doesn't in this slide, and still there is a good agreement. And as I show you later, actually, the disconnected pieces for the vector form factor, they are on the like percent level, as well as strange form factors. Right. So now the radius, and this is the summary slide that I had from 2013. The big problem with lattice calculation of the radius, in addition to excited states and all that, is that there is a logarithmic divergence in the pion mass. So you can expect that if you go towards the Carroll limit, that there is a strong dependence on the pion mass. And it was absolutely crucial to go as close to the physical pion mass as was possible at the moment. As you see, the swarm of points from the various collaborations slowly going up. And this is our data point from 2012. The uncertainty here, if you look just at one sigma range, it is comparable to the difference between the two values from experiment. So this is the quantity which is not the radius, not the charge radius of the proton itself. This is built from, this is the Dirac radius, and it's the difference between proton and neutron. The advantage of this quantity for lattice is that it doesn't give disconnected diagrams again. So if we believe that the neutron radius data is reliable, which is determined from scattering on lead, then we can use this as a benchmark for lattice QCD and also check back which of the radius values agrees better with
On one hand, you are saying that, you know, neglecting this C clock is not very problematic in terms of comparison, right? Because when you show the picture. On the other hand, this pion exchange, it is a signal of the C clocks, right? Because it's a pair of clock and clock X, right? Inside there.
Not the isovector, I think.
There is no one pion exchange, right? In the form factor. So it is you are kind of emitting pion and so it's like nucleon goes to nucleon plus pion, right? And then pion interacts with
there's two different things going on here. One is you're including the strong direction disconnected loops, but you're not including the ones where the current goes onto it.
No, but the log is only due to this. Log of n pi, it's only due to
there are times you can draw a continuous chord line through that produces a pion loop by having
But why it will give you log?
Yeah. Because of the chiral divergence, because it's producing a long range pion.
Yeah.
I see. So you mean not just a pion exchange, I mean pion goes in, out, and...
Yeah, but if you look at the quark level, there are two ways of getting that. You can have a disconnected quark loop, or you can have a quark line that zigzags backwards and forwards.
So it would give a divergence with a different coefficient,
yeah.
But it would still be there.
Yeah.
Another question, back to the form factors you showed before. We have also comparison for the neutron form factor separately, since, in the vector form factor, it's dominated by the proton. So at small q, the neutron form factor is close to zero, and then it has maximum at some q. But this vector form factor is always dominated by the proton part. So it would be interesting to see the neutron part, so comparison for the neutron separately.
Well, I believe we have figures for the neutron, but I didn't include them.
Did I hear you to say you thought we knew the neutron radius better than the proton radius?
Yeah.
Do we?
I don't think.
Well,
the neutron radius is known very well.
It's so small that the uncertainty doesn't.
So it's from scattering of neutrons on molten lead, I believe, on the electron clouds around the
electrons.
Yeah.
Very well, Q.
But I still think that in terms of hadronic description, the only reason for log of n pi, it is diagram where you emitted pi from nucleon and absorbs it, and this pion, the charged pion interacts with photon. It's the only one which gives log. I'm not sure how it looks like in the latest language, but in terms of this stuff, anything else doesn't give you log of n pi.
I think that's correct.
Right. Do you remember the
truth? But that's partly included using.
Yeah, but it means that this diagram in latest language does include different pieces in the latest language.
So those sort of dynamics are included, not completely, but.
I probably have just not understanding.
In a completely controlled way.
But would you, I mean, where the question could be answered, in a French approximation, would you see the log or not?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, then
So there's a partially quench framework that exists to describe these types of processes.
Okay, so this is the many questions have been asked about the precision and all that, and excited states. So here's what we did to control the excited states at the physical point. This is a sequence of measurements of the radius with increasing source-sink separation, and then we sort of extrapolate to infinite source-sink separation, well, extract the ground state value. And so this is the point that we got. So there is a band here with a Carl extrapolation, the log m pi. So actually the error bar is determined by the heaviest pion mass point, so probably shouldn't be taken into account seriously. But what is interesting is that the error bar here is comparable to the difference between experimental values. And so it is within reach to improve this precision. At least stochastic precision, we can do very well. The systematic error, again, it's there are debates now how to do the excited states, how to exclude them best.
The right. Radius in these plots is obtained from some kind of extrapolation at the moment in Q squared.
Yes, and this the radius is obtained from.
We'll have to change, obviously.
From the dipole fit to data between 0 and 0.5 GV squared,
yeah, so,
or 0.4.
Mm-hmm. So it should be taken with a big pinch of salt, because we know that that's very unreliable for real experimental data. There's no reason why it should be more reliable for lattice data.
That is true, but the current precision, it's...
the current precision, it may work.
It really doesn't matter, because we tried different fit forms, and they basically delivered the same kind of radius value.
What about different values of Qmax? You hardly have that option because you only have three.
We also tried changing the range too. Yeah.
That doesn't make a difference? Not within your errors, perhaps.
Not within our errors, that's right. Yeah. The errors are large enough so that they forgiving.
Assuming you accurately reproduce the real physical form factor, it will make a difference because it does when you use highly, very precise real-world data.
Well, what we currently do, we switch to the z-factor, z-expansion, z-parameter expansion, where...
So people do that on the real-world data as well?
Yeah, on the axial form factor, and I believe also on the vector.
Oh, very much on this. There's a lot of literature now to show that there are real difficulties in getting the slope at zero from a finite Q. Extrapolation,
where
finite can be really quite small.
I wonder, when you are defining this radius, you can, you also do extrapolation in Q square, or you are defining a delta which is responsible for the radius? Theoretically, you can define, just put Q equals zero, right? I mean, Q square equals zero from the very beginning.
How do you do that in practice?
Not just differentiating the exponent and having
well, there are difficulties on the lattice because you have finite volume, momentum is quantized, you cannot actually take the derivative directly. You can rely on some tricks. So differentiating with respect to momentum will give you x squared,
from,
right?
From continuum and then say that you are calculating mad experiment already. I mean, for expanded stuff, right?
So what you're probably saying is that I should take the charge density operator and weight it with the x squared.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm asking. Right?
Well,
now, the thing is that there are periodic boundary conditions, and then when your final state, so the initial state is more or less localized, as we discussed, but the final state we project on the zero momentum, and if you wait long enough, it is spread over the entire volume, right? And then you have boundary conditions, and you have to,
Also, the radius isn't, can't be calculated like that. It's not
They're actually
blend in the form factor and for something as light as a proton.
In this year's Lattice conference, people presented the results doing exactly what you say, but they don't go too long, too far in time. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would expect they would have problems.
I'm actually curious about that because we're trying to do the same thing in Lattice effective field theory calculations. But the problem we have is probably the same problem you have in Lattice QCD, in that you don't know where the center mass actually is. So you can't calculate radius unless you know where it is for a given configuration. And we have to actually determine that by calculating an A-body operator. So I'm not quite sure how you do that in Lattice QCD.
Well, in Lattice QCD, there is a strict definition of what the current matrix element is. Right, so basically our center of mass would be the position of the initial source, because all the phases all the plane waves are computed with respect to that initial position.
Yeah, but it diffuses as a function of Euclidean time, so you have to know what's going on. So I'm just saying it's a subtle thing. It's actually, we'll start with this.
If one of the quarks is an infinite Hibby quark,
Yeah, exactly.
Well defined, but it's not.
Give a solution to
helpful example.
Today's statement of the bleeding on.
If you have a solution to this, we'd love to know, because this is what we're working at right now.
Well, I think in this formalism, it doesn't actually require a solution, because if you formally look at the matrix element and how you write it out in terms of form factors, then you don't need any kind of center of mass.
No, so, but you do need arbitrary low Q squared.
That is true, yes. That is absolutely true.
So it would be nice if you could come up with an operator that didn't require extrapolation in Q squared.
Right.
A lot of the problems.
But these moment methods people are using, the Hadronic vacuum polarization, they are doing essentially this. They are getting to extremely low momentum transfers.
That is true. And so I. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think they rely on the raw mass falloff.
No.
Well, but
depending on which methods you're talking about, there are some that are obviously
looking. So what I'm worried about in proton radius calculations is that if you basically will be limited in the time, Euclidean time, how far you can go.
Yeah. So it's harder for this than for vacuum polarization.
It's what?
It's harder for this than for vacuum polarization because the noise is worse.
Yeah.
I can believe that. So.
And you probably want higher accuracy.
Well, it's not just the noise, right? If I go far away and my density at the sink spreads far enough to cover the entire volume, being projected on the zero momentum, right? How do I deal with that? So once my x squared reaches, weighted with the charge density, reaches around the lattice, then I won't have any valid information anymore.
It should be the same for Hadron vacuum polarization. You also want to choose a particular magnitude.
I don't know. We have to look carefully at what they're doing. Maybe they don't have to go to, maybe they are not just end up in the situation where they have to have a widespread density of their whatever they're measuring the momentum of. Right? Okay, just to show sort of miraculous success or just a maybe fortuitous success with the anomalous magnetic moment and the Pauli radius. So again, in both cases, there are substantial excited states contributions, noticeable excited states contributions, but in both cases, the physical point and the extrapolation agree very well with the experiment. So the thing is that actually this has the same problem as the radius. Because we don't have the value at the zero. Obviously for the radius we don't have the derivative, but for the form factor F2 itself at zero we have to extrapolate from non-zero momenta, because as you see in the forward limit it just falls out of the matrix element, and we have to rely on something like a dipole form or Z expansion or something like that. So to overcome this we either have to go to large volumes to decrease the minimal non-zero momentum transfer, or use twisted boundary conditions. And actually what we did instead of using boundary conditions, twisted boundary conditions, we sort of put the infinitesimal phase shift at the boundary, and then expand with respect to it, and it generates, so then you can see that if you do some algebra, you can see that the derivative of the propagator with respect to this phase shift will be exactly the derivative of the propagator at zero momentum with respect to this momentum. And all you have to do is to put a sort of additional vertex in the quark line, and this will effectively produce the first term expansion in this delta B in your chosen direction. And this seems to work quite well for the for the value of the form factor itself at zero. Well, the error bar actually is it's comparable to the error bar at the smallest non-zero momentum, but if you look at the extrapolation result, it is larger, although it's probably not a fair comparison. For the radius, the method works. Actually, sorry, this is not correct. This is the Dirac radius, not the Pauli radius. For the Dirac radius, the method works somewhat worse because you have to take the second derivative of the term like this, and then it has more noise. And currently there are ideas how to organize, how to take derivatives in a different way. Let's say take derivative on different sides of the propagator.
So the twist is only in the valence quarks, it's not in the...
Yes, the twist is only in the valence quarks, and in the C quarks, actually, I don't know if you can even... I don't know how to do the twisting.
Phase operation problem, right? Well, I guess if phase is small, it's not a big deal.
Well, for the C, you have a trace of D slash, right? The trace of the inverse Dirac operator, and then it means, since you have only one Dirac operator, you cannot have it both twisted and untwisted. And you have to have a contraction of twisted and untwisted to have some non-zero small momentum for the twisting. And if you have only one, then...
But again, you know, if you are following this prime loop, right, then the prime loop look again like a C quark, right, because it's extra pair quark and D quark, which interacts with one in addition to what is there, right? So it's like, five quark, normal quark plus... was pair, right? Then you are not, maybe this contribution is not that crucial for comparison, but I think that when you're saying that C quarks are not important, it looks like not exactly consistent.
Well, I never said this. A priori, we don't know.
You don't know.
We will compute them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just I have to make one step at a time. But the point is that.
So computationally, it's relatively cheap to do twisting on the valence sector, but it's expensive to do twisting in the C sector because you have to regenerate all the configurations again.
Oh, okay,
so that's
yes.
Why, that's why yeah. It's being done like it is. It's a limitation of compute power at the moment.
No, but you can have a polarization of the C, right?
There's a partial twisting effect that is present for sure, yes.
So you can have a quark loops, right? That's what you mean by C. But I was confused. Maybe you there are also these disconnected contributions, right? That
right,
contribute to isoscalar.
Right. Prime is in this way, it's different, but it still involves extra anti-quarks, right? Besides what happens, right? And in this sense, it's similar to this disconnected area. In the sense that it's not just involves not just.
Well, there are C quarks that just on their own in the vacuum, and then there are sort of those that couple to the operator that I want to measure. Those are called disconnected, and those we don't know how to do twisting boundary condition on, of the boundary conditions. So we just have to believe that their contributions to the radius will be small, and I'll show you why.
Do you understand how to do that?
Twisting on the disconnected.
On the C.
You can generate gauge configurations with twisted C, right? But you cannot do disconnected with the twisted with small momentum because it's the same momentum in, same momentum out. It's quantized always, whether you do or not do the twisting. All right. Okay. Now, what about the strange quark? So, an experiment you have to measure at least three different things to disentangle the flavors, including the strange. So you can measure the form factors of the proton, of the neutron, and then you also have to measure the interference between gamma and z scattering due to gamma and Z exchange. And then you have different combinations of the form factors, and that's how they are extracted in experiment in HOPX, G0, E4, something else. So the problem that these experiments have, they typically they get a very correlated results for electric and magnetic form factors. So here you see the bands from experiment. This is GE, the strange quark on the y-axis, GM of the strange quarks on the x-axis, and you have these bands from which you hope to extract the G and GM. So what we can do on the lattice is compute them directly, but this involves these disconnected diagrams of this type, so we have to sum over all the positions on the time slice, inverting the D slash operator. And that used to be very expensive, but then the smart people came up with the advanced techniques how to do that, how to reduce the noise in the estimators. Obviously, you cannot do this directly. You have to do some stochastic estimation, and then this, it comes with its variance, which you can reduce, as it turns out. So here, there are contributions of the strange quark in the black to the electric form factor and to the magnetic form factor. So the blue band is what it would be like if the strange quark mass would be equal to the light quark mass. So these are the unaccounted for contributions to the proton form factor. And as you see on the Y scale there of the percent level magnitude compared to the main connected contribution that was shown before. So indeed, we believe that we can neglect them most of the time, at least at the level of precision. So if we wanted to extract the radius from the contribution to the radius from this form factor, for example, we would have to rely on some kind of analogical shape. But first, probably wouldn't care about systematic uncertainties in this case because we know it has to come to zero here, and if we have relatively precise points here. And second, the contributions itself are quite small, both for the electric and magnetic. And we extracted also the contributions to the the strange form factor radii for electric and magnetic one, and the magnetic from the strange quark, which it's coming next. Next slide. On this slide, I show the comparison of the lattice data to experiment. So to do a fair comparison, we don't compare electric and magnetic separately because these things are, as I said, they're very correlated and come with huge error bars. Instead, what's plotted on the y-axis is a linear combination of G and GM, which the coefficients depend on the momentum according to experiment kinematics. And we sort of model this, pretend doing the same with the lattice data just to show the size of the error bars compared. And it's probably not a very good news for experiment, which are basically measuring zero, but with a much larger error bar at the moment.
So they should save some money and give it to you.
Well, I think first we have to convince everyone that lattice works very well. And this was done with the heavier Klein mass, by the way. So there are systematic things that we have to work on.
Right. So, mass or extrapolate then from this mass to the.
This, I believe this is not extrapolated. This is the.
Result.
With the 317, yeah. MeV. Okay, and here is the comparison of the strange contribution to the magnetic moment. There are logical estimates of this quantity, and the two results for the raw value from the lattice and the extrapolated one. It was a kind of naive attempt at extrapolation in this quantity. This is a partially quenched Chi-PT inspired kind of extrapolation, just linear in the quark masses. Right. Okay. Now the axial form factors they're interesting, obviously, because they tell us how the neutrinos scatter of nucleons, nuclei. Well, that's probably the main reason. The experiments that are done in addition to neutrino scattering are, for example, muon capture experiment, where this form factor can be measured at one particular Q squared value. So here is the fairly recent result. You probably know about this result, which was just from 2012. So this is the value that we would like to reproduce in the lattice for the induced pseudoscalar form factor. For the axial form factor, there is still quite a bit of uncertainty. So this is a summary of data up to 2001 from the famous review. And again, the problem there is that people relied heavily on the dipole kind of fit forms, which led to underestimation of error bars. I'll come back to the form factor later, but the forward value of the form factor, as you know, is the axial charge. So here's the summary of lattice data. The experimental point is here, and I'm sure you all know the axial charge has, is still a problem for lattice QCD, although it's becoming less so. So this is the summary by Sarah Collins from lattice 2016. The second picture zooms in on the physical point. So there are three collaborations doing calculations straight at the physical point. There are still questions about these calculations. For example, the ETMC calculation is using somewhat small lattice volumes. So this MPIL volume measure is around 3 for their calculation. But still, the situation sort of improves, we can believe that, because there are independent collaborations doing this calculation, and they have the value which is reasonably close to the experimental one.
But it is systematically lower, right?
It looks like it. It's still a bit low, yes.
Especially below the physical point, where presumably, there's strong chiral dependence.
Actually, do we know that there is a strong chiral dependence?
Yes. We know that there is predicted to be lattice conspicuously fails to show it.
Well, the lattice data, as you see, over a very wide range, it's
if you're going to fit in data,
very, very flat.
It has to.
So those data sets were actually at m pi squared physical, or was it actually below m pi squared? Did you shift it?
There's a real
Some actually are lower than physical point.
But those explicitly, I asked her, those are shifted so that you could actually see them.
I think if they are shifted, then not very significant. They basically were aiming at the physical point.
Not perfectly at the physical point, but yeah, closer than it looks there. Okay.
Yeah.
Actually,
I'm
curious about the summary plot usually presented for GA. You can see the four masses.
More like 1.1 typically.
Well, typically I would say the value that people consistently got was somewhere around 1.15, 1.2 in this.
It's a smaller range. It's a smaller plot interval than the pi squared.
It's a smaller range of n pi squared for sure.
Until about 4 or 5 years ago, there were no points below n pi squared at 0.3.
Yeah.
Okay.
M pi, you mean?
No points for like.
Yeah, there
squared.
Were no reliable points until four years ago, I would say.
There's an awful lot more. There's an awful lot been done over the last 4 years.
Well, it's one of the reasons is that lattice community was criticized for GA, and a lot of people put a lot of effort into that, trying to do simulations at the physical point or very close to that. And this actually didn't happen overnight. People increased, put a lot of effort into controlling excited states, for example. It was a long cold belief that you must have a very large volume to reproduce GA, and actually didn't, it wasn't confirmed robustly.
And this kind of channel is kind of less dependful on mass of pi, because it is, I mean, it's only starting from C pi, and you know, there is no kind of significant dependence of anything pi expected, right? So in this way, this should be better for the latest calculation.
Well, the way I remember the chiral extrapolations were done like 6 years ago, people had a wide range of chiral extrapolation formulae, and the range of predictions was very wide.
It is.
Like including the delta, for example, or not including the delta.
Yes. SU2 versus SU3. I know I have two which is done this that we've not published because we don't get anything consistent here.
Itself.
Okay. Because I'm not doing very well on time, right? Okay, so now what about the shape of the form factor itself? So here is the summary from Lattice 2013. No, it's actually a review from 2013. Here you see the comparison of the sort of the common value for experiments, the dipole form from experiments versus lattice data, and there is a lot of disagreement here, but not very much pi and mass dependence. So you can play the same game trying to plot the radius versus m pi, or actually in this case not the radius but the axial mass in the dipole fit, and this quantity does not exhibit very much dependence on the pion mass. So there are two more recent experiments from K2K and Miniboon, which have larger error bars, which have been later reconciled. So this is the current prediction with the better control of the model. So the lattice sort of misses that, and of course the goal for the lattice is to do the calculation of this axial mass right at the physical point with control of.
Error is not a physical thing.
No.
Right. So this is of course useful for parameterization, which is commonly used, but I guess for the latest PC community, it would be still preferable to work with extra radius instead.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not guaranteed to be more.
The axial radius, you mean the
This is just a parameterization.
Yeah.
So basically, you're saying you need the form factor in the vicinity of zero, right?
Yeah.
Just make an extension and then you can define axial radius and high coefficients exactly the same way.
Or just compare to data.
Yeah.
But the experimental community needs the form factor in the wide range of Q squared, right?
Yeah. So let's compare the way you did with the.
Basically, we should throw out the dipole and never use it again.
Yes.
I guess it's a legacy.
No, I disagree. I mean, the experimentalists are using it.
Yeah, but they shouldn't.
But they should.
But they're tuning. I mean, all the Miniboon analysis is based on this, and they're tuning LA to put in data. That's probably.
Oh, but that's silly.
They're going to what long baseline programs.
So don't encourage them.
I think you could show that their analysis is internally inconsistent.
Right. The force of this scale.
I mean, until when the errors are at a certain level, you'll always be able to fit to something like that. But.
Since this is a nuclear fit, so this is scattering of nuclei, right? So there's, when you record an MA from experiment, this is a nuclear model. That goes into, do you know the dependence?
No.
I mean, how would those things change?
Well, this is outside of single nucleon structure.
Okay.
But, that would be a nice program.
So
actually, I think.
It changes by 30% when
yes.
There's a nuclei.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
That's a hugely.
Has there been a proposal with Joe Carlson to do.
I know,
but this,
I mean, he claims that the nuclear set is more important. You guys claim that the axial form factor is more important. I'm asking.
Well, I think you have to do both things
there,
right.
I don't think they're claiming anything of the kind.
You have to do both things right.
Is there a guide, I mean, idea for okay, whatever, yeah.
It'd probably be nice to use to put something like helium-3 on the lattice, right, and try to measure the form factor of that.
But
you must be already doing that, no?
The experiments here be done for high Q squared, and so actually the nucleon result's really important. It's going to be sort of typically 2 GeV Mann transfer. Mm-hmm. And right now they're using solely Fermi gas models with form factors. So.
Are we sure that this is?
So how is nuclear effect, how are nuclear effects important in that regime?
Right now the experimentals are ignoring it entirely.
Right.
And even Joe can't really address that because you're at a Q squared where you no longer can use really a potential model. Mm-hmm. It's really a problem. Mm-hmm. So you're probably the only thing that can actually be done right.
Yeah.
Except you need argon.
Yeah, put argon on all that.
Or water, maybe. Okay, so here is the picture of the GP form factor. And we indeed, I think the question was about that, right? We indeed see the strong dependence on the pion mass. So here, for example, I used the results with the range of pion masses from 300 to 600 and filtered to fairly loose form with three parameters. So each form factor was at each point, pion mass was fit to this form, and then the pole mass comes out like this, where the diagonal line would correspond to exact m pole equal to m pi. Here is an example how the form factor actually agrees with the this is the line I think for the physical pion mass, right? And here's, for example, the calculation right at the physical pion mass. Now with the chiral quarks, the problem that we have in GP specifically is that the excited states seem to be larger than anything else we have seen so far. So we really have to be careful to control them if we want to study this.
Yeah, but here, in certain sense, you know, there is no doubt about pion dominance, right? And in this sense, it's kind of checking pion n coupling constant itself, right? Because it's a residue which depends on this, right? So in this way, you can reformulate it as a calculation of pion n coupling on the lattice.
That is right. So the RQCD collaboration recently published a paper about exactly that. So they studied a range of pion masses, and they did a careful analysis of the Q squared dependence, and they extrapolated this equivalent of the mu cap value to the physical point, and they got excellent agreement with that. Ooh. Yeah, here's their result, and here is the mu cap value, which is, I think, a triumph for them.
It's around the Goldberg retrievement value. It's special value. Somewhere around there.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But it's not exactly that. It's like 10% off or something, no? Okay, so again, the strange quarks, which have been done just this year, they will be measured at Miniboon. Well, the data is gathered still, as far as I understand, and then they, I hope they will publish something. I think there was some Q-squared report, Q-squared dependence report of this strange quark contribution to the axial form factor, but it wasn't very precise. So this is an example where a lattice can outpace experiment. This is still a heavy pion mass, the same 317, but in principle, now there is a technology to go right to the physical pion mass. So for example, the development of algorithms like such as multigrid really make the pion mass not a very large issue for measuring the quantities on the lattice. Generating ensemble is still sort of an issue, but with the existing technology, if we have lattice configurations, if we're you know, if we get some, first, if we get time to generate lattice configurations at the physical point, then getting from there to the, for example, strange contribution to the axial form factor will be a very simple task. And this the method that is used here demonstrates that, well, actually, it's not very difficult, as was believed before, to do disconnected and strange form factors on the lattice. One interesting thing to notice here is that if we use the range of Q squared to extrapolate to zero, not just the forward value for the GS, then we have a better estimate for the GS at zero. And this is the contribution of the strange quark spin to the proton spin, which is very interesting in itself.
I'm not sure that it should be defined as a proton spin because gamma mu gamma phi one factor, right? It's just spin only conditionally.
This is the same as delta S in the deep inelastic scattering.
No, right, but I mean that in this way does still say that it is value of a factor at zero rather than because it's, spin is more complicated because it includes orbital and whatever gluons and.
I'm talking just about the strange quark polarization. Yeah. So it's a, you can say quark spin, but you can also say contribution of quark polarization to the proton spin. So, but this is exactly what the delta S average is. So, all right. So the value that is here shown here is also shown here compared to previous lattice calculations. All right, so one of the issues we had to overcome in this was the mixing between the light and strange form factors because, you know, the axial is no longer conserved. So we had to untangle this mixing, which basically required a similar kind of trick where we needed disconnected contributions to the lattice non-perturbative renormalization constants. And the effect, fortunately, turned out to be fairly small in the strange form factor. It's only noticeable in the strange GA. It just shifts the central value by something that is smaller than the error bar. But we're glad we have done this, so there are no uncertainties. Because before that, the main way to untangle the mixing was to do lattice perturbative calculations for the renormalization.
So the mixing of strange into light.
Strange and light, yes.
But the strange, this is the mixing of light into strange you're showing here, right?
You mean this?
The other part.
The other part is.
The shift is due to the mixing of the light back into the strange, right?
Yeah, I think this is the raw lattice strange one of them, the no mixing part, and then the after the subtraction of the light contribution. Upon mixing. Right. Okay, now I think I'll just go very quickly over this recent work we have done for the N and bar transition matrix elements. So as you know, that's one of the avenues to look for baryon number violation. And it is interesting, because it's a process which is completely different from proton decay, where baryon number is changed by one. It can have implications for nuclear matter stability because if, you know, N can transition to N bar, then two neutrons can in principle annihilate. And it also probes the beyond the standard model physics, looking for transitions where the B minus L number is violated. So it has been sort of experiments unsuccessfully. So the experiment put a lower bound on the transition time of order 10 to 8 seconds, and also it was sought in the quasi-free neutrons, where neutrons are allowed to fly towards the target, and if they change their nature into antineutrons, they will produce a very strong signal at the target, obviously due to annihilation. And this experiment actually can be improved compared to the observations in the lots of mass. So the first kind of experiments was similar to Kamiokande, right, where you have a reducible background from atmospheric neutrinos. But the quasi-neutrino experiments can be improved, and there are multiple ideas how to do that, such as focusing neutrons better and, in general, allowing them to fly longer. Currently proposed experiments promise to improve the lower bound on the transition time by one or two orders of magnitude, which will probe or maybe eliminate extensions of the standard model, some of them. Right, so the physics of, from the nuclear structure point of view, what we have to do is to compute the core nucleon matrix elements of the six core cooperators, they have been categorized. The main question is, what is the scale at which these operators are generated by the beyond the standard model extensions? And so this is what we have done, basically computed these matrix elements. So there are two kinds. The first kind is electroweak singlet, in which can cause the end-to-end bar transitions at the trio level, but there are also electroweak non-singlets, which can cause the transitions with one loop if you include the W boson in the loop.
But there's quite a number of different operators, right? So
yeah.
When you're calculating, you're choosing particular ones.
The original paper that classified them stated that there were seven, right? Actually, one of them is precisely zero in the isospin limit. Then three are related by the same isospin symmetry. So we end up with just the four numbers, which we have to compute on the lattice. And I show here the ratio of the previous of our calculation to previous BAG model calculations. So it's interesting that this number is, for the electroweak singlet operators, it's between 5 and 10. So compared to what was previously thought, lattice QCD predicts that experiments should be 5 to 10 times more sensitive to whatever exists beyond the standard model. Another thing is that, so there was a recently a paper where these matrix elements, this particular matrix elements show up. And as you see, the BAG model actually have a range that bracket zero, right? So depending on which version of the BAG model, which fit of the BAG model you use, you can end up with the numbers with a different sign. So the uncertainty is basically more than 100%.
In terms of nuclear stability, it would be very different than experiment, because here this Newton anti-Newton transition, right? In nuclear, you can have, say, annihilation of two nucleons into something, changing the ionic charge by two units, but, you know, in the annihilation channel, you do not consider this, right?
No nuclear effects.
It's a very different type of process.
Well, I would think that it would heavily depend on the nuclear effects, right? Which hopefully someday we will be able to do.
So what are the uncertainties on the lattice results?
Well, these are preliminary uncertainties, but they're typically on the level of 10%.
That's systematic.
That's including the renormalization, yeah, and the excitancies. The data is actually pretty clean in this case, surprisingly. Just want to flash this model predictions for the NN bar transition rate. So in a particular model which unifies quarks and leptons, assuming that the baryogenesis happens below the electroweak phase transition, and also assuming that the CP violation is only that comes from the standard model, it's possible to estimate the upper bound for the transition rate. And this upper bound actually depends on the matrix element that is electroweak non-singlet. It was shown in the previous page. I won't waste your time doing that. So BAG model estimates this, as I said, at bracket zero, for example. So it's a big uncertainty on that. Whereas lattice gives first gives much less uncertainty and also some definite sign value, thus reducing the upper bound prediction by well, also there are some renormalization issues, different scales and such. So we ended up with a 2.5 times smaller upper bound.
But CP violation, you know, from standard model, but delta B equal 2, not from the standard model.
That is right.
So in this way, I mean, there is no limitation for CP violation because it exists.
Right? That is right. If you believe that there is more CP violation, then, you know, Bayer genesis is easier to come up with the right amount, right? And then you don't need such a strict upper bound for tau. But, you know, there is no additional CP violation found so far.
Is it inequality of the right sign?
Yeah, it's upper bound.
It's like a low bound. Yeah.
Yeah. Where?
That one, yeah. The lifetime is less than.
Yeah. You made some assumption about the mass, right? 1/m².
Yeah, there are quite a few assumptions in the model, yeah. So the model is quite intricate. Yeah, for example, it does not generate an upper bound from the direct tree level end to end bar transitions. There is some reason why it has to be one loop specifically, and it results in the end you have to use this matrix element, which is very small and actually has a value which not even defined very well by the BAG model. So you have to do something else.
Sergey, this talk's not that familiar with me to me, but why is it that the stability of so many nuclei doesn't constrain the oscillation time much more? What is the big factor that makes the constraint so weaker than I would have thought?
So neutron to antineutron transition, you can think about it as a 2x2 Hamiltonian, right? And then there is off-diagonal element that causes this transition. Now, if there is some background effect that, for example, increases the energy of neutron, decreases the energy of antineutron, let's say magnetic field, they also have the same spin, right? So if you put the system in the magnetic field, it will suppress the transitions. Just if you write out the quantum mechanical transition amplitude. Now, if you, instead of magnetic field, you put this into inside the nucleus, where the background effects compared to magnetic field are, you know, like 100 MeV kind
so,
of interaction.
So the magnetic field is really crucial for suppressing this annihilation.
Right. So the crucial thing in experiments that search for these transitions is to isolate the volume from magnetic field. And you have to isolate like a 100 meter long pipe. You have to shield it from magnetic field. That's one of the major difficulties. And also then if you create neutrons which have to fly over this 100 meters, you cannot create them, less than 100 meters a second, right, easily. So you have to use as cold neutrons as you can come up with.
But for nuclear stability, it's different, right?
Right, but I was just saying that explaining why you have to take care of the background, of the medium effects, right? And the medium effect in one experiment, it's just a magnetic field that you can, in principle, try to shield. In the other case, when you look for these effects inside the nucleus, it is the nuclear interaction. And it's you know, what is it like? Tens of orders of magnitude larger.
Yeah, that's a pretty big suppression because the lifetime can be brought up to like 10 to 33 years now.
Yeah.
So it's pretty dramatic.
Well, the result, interestingly, the lower bound on the transition rates. So in the experiments that look at the nuclei, they look for the decay rate, right? Then they make some assumptions or calculations from the nuclear models, how the nuclear effects suppress these transition rates. And then they convert their result to the same transition rate. And the transition rate happens to be comparable. So in one case, we have slightly then 10 to 8 seconds in the quasi-free flying neutrons. In the other case, we have, 3 times, 4 times larger limit.
So, I'm sorry. I mean, nuclear gives you suppression, and the way how it calculates suppression, it enters into this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Suppression factor, right?
Yeah.
In units of.
An extraordinary mismatch of scales.
Exactly.
Could one predict, for instance, any sizable effect in a neutral star?
Yeah.
I'm also very much interested in that too. I'm yet to ask this question.
There are also
related valence
statistics
on
this side. I mean,
no. So I played with this a little bit, and it doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah. You can't. You can't beat these nuclei.
All right.
So you mean that these events can happen inside neutron stars, but they're rare, right?
Right, well, you want to see, does
the
neutron star
collapse, disappear,
yeah.
Go away?
Does something bad happen to your neutron star? And the answer
Wait,
is,
no,
pulsars suddenly.
You have a larger density, right?
Right, you have a much larger density, but you also have huge magnetic fields and...
Do magnetic fields even enter the consideration?
Well, if you have 10 to the 24 Gauss or something, you know.
Oh. Do you really have the magnetic field like that then?
In astrophysical settings, 10 to the 14.
No, but if you the star as a detector, then in principle you would have a signature of the then it's a huge nuclear, right? So then you could have much more events. I mean, but you need some signal of.
The only signal we'd be sure of was the whole thing disappearing.
Right, that's the issue, is that if this thing happens inside the neutron star,
yeah.
Never, ever.
That's how you see.
So the whole star has to evaporate much more quickly than any other astrophysical signal.
In other words, just not, it would put a limit on the existence of neutron stars.
Right. And it's just not, it's not a useful limit.
Also the cooling of neutron stars as well.
That
would be maybe also with a strong magnetic field as well.
Interesting.
All right, yeah, I'm done. Just
question whether there are benchmarks that you can do, for example, on the PION system to make sure that everything you do for the nucleon is really accurate in terms of form factors to calculate radii and whatnot. Because with PIONs, obviously, you can do much higher precision.
The Meson sector has been studied very thoroughly, and I believe the Meson sector is fine. But it's not clear how to judge the nucleon sector when you put a nucleon on the lattice. So one of the biggest things we have to deal now with is the excited states. And you know, we just don't know how to use the Meson information for that. If somebody came up with a model for excited states using the Carl perturbation theory, that would be very useful.
But you could check, for example, the systematic errors and the twisting of just the valence versus the full twisting. You could do that to a client case and see if it makes a difference. I'm just saying that benchmarks.
Well, there are what we call benchmarks related to the nucleon itself, or GA, for example, is one of them. So that we consider as a benchmark. So I think the understanding is that once the agreement for GA is reached and we understand everything about GA, then we have to apply the same kind of methodology to everything else, because that's the only way we can hope we're doing the right thing for the radius, for example. Yes?
Okay, for the nucleon spin, you just chose the first moment of the delta S density. Do we have the other four? So
other than the for the S quark, it can be calculated. I don't know what the signal will be because we haven't done it yet.
Okay.
So, but I believe we have data stored that can be used to extract. For the S quark, this probably be quite easy. For the light quark, well, actually, for isoscalar combination of these things, the problem will be that it will mix For example, for the second moment, it will mix with gluons. And we, one of the plans for, you know, for the near future is to understand how to do mixing and renormalization of gluons and where gluons and quarks operators mix with each other.
Your paper has shown many related results, so I'm curious. Those are always results of the related disciplines, or you just think, you know, large enough layers and, you know, put the uncertainty in it.
Well, typically what I show is the fixed lattice volume. There are, for example, sometimes there are points with the different volume at the same pine mass, same lattice spacing, but they're shown, if they are, they're shown as separate points. And it's, unfortunately, it's not the norm yet to use the finite, infinite volume extrapolation for all the quantities, because it's rather expensive. Some collaboration can do that for some quantities, but it's not like widespread yet.
And the same for the lattice spacing, these are results with the fixed lattice spacing?
Yeah, and typically with the fixed lattice spacing.
That may be true for your own results. What about the cases when you showed compendia, those perhaps more likely to have extrapolation, like all the different people's values for GA?
So in this plot, everything is fixed volume, fixed lattice spacing.
But I mean, individual groups contribute to this plot, do extrapolation.
Right. Yeah. So each group, when it has its own data, they when they publish a paper, they do the analysis like that. But there are differences in how to do this analysis, how to do the extrapolations, and then, you know, it's...
In principle, this is very unfair, because if you do infinite statistics, it's quite not agree with each other.
That's right. Yeah. We had an interesting discussion with our collaborators. You can set up a very precise calculation, but completely useless.
As yet, we're not there yet.
Actually, there is an effort. There is a flag group, right, that does the flavor lattice averaging, and there is the effort now started to do the same for nucleon observables. But the criteria are not solid yet, I would say. There is some discussion how to do this fairly.
So this is a bit of a political question, I know, but what is one to make? Well, maybe you've answered it, that you wouldn't expect them to agree because there are different volumes and so on. But you do get points with very small errors at very similar masses that agree quite violently.
Disagree quite
badly.
Okay, so.
I mean, are they underestimating their errors? Are systematic?
Well, those are different lattice sections. They can have different discretization effects.
So, I mean, I know, for instance, that the heavier masses, some of the disagreement is because one group did not include systematic uncertainties. Because.
But is there any way to include systematic uncertainties? Like, we have a agreed way to calculate that.
Only they can do it.
Standard practice is just to explain exactly what you did.
Right. So with something like lattice spacing and finite volume, if you have multiple points, right, you can do extrapolation, and those are independent data points. So you can include whatever, you can explore the range of models for extrapolation and fit forms, and then you can cite that as a systematic error. But with excited states, I would say there is no consensus how to do the analysis, and every collaboration tries to do their best. One thing that's heavily debated now is the two-state fit. For example, when the excited states are believed to be modeled by just one additional excited state, and that has, it may have problems if you don't pin down the energy gap precisely.
But then is it allowed for somebody who is not in the field and looks at lattice QCD result to say the stage is that the error bar is now the difference between one result which is here and one result which is there. So this is the error bar. Is it allowed to do that for us? And
why not?
Why not?
Well, at least I think you should ask the lattice person
the
how to how to understand the error bars that are quoted.
No, not the error bars that are quoted, but the bands that you get.
The band.
But you would put everything on top.
So if I have one thing here and one thing there, I would, looking from outside, I said, okay, these people are striving to get statistical and systematic, but at the moment, this is the uncertainty.
But Sergey does argue that there are common systematic errors like the lattice size.
So not even that, then it's even
then could you not say that?
Could it be a minimum? A minimum.
To make it even worse, that this is only the lower bound on the systematic error.
Yes, the minimum.
Yeah, you probably can say that, yeah. To be very conservative, you can say that this range is what Lattice QCD thinks about.
I think it's not right, because some of the groups will have done it right, and that really is the uncertainty complete. And others will not have done a full quantification of uncertainties, and their point is just wrong.
If you look at the 6 points that are in teal at 0.06, right, those are different lattice spacings, different volumes. And if you ask the question, what is GA in some fixed volume, one of those points tells you the answer. If you ask the question, what is GA in nature, well, you shouldn't look at those points. You should extrapolate everything. And they do. Right? So this summary is not fair to at the actual calculation, because you're comparing things that, if you had a perfect data, would just not agree.
If they're a better prepared.
Yeah, that is true.
Probably not. Right?
So what you're saying is that the results are not all qualitatively equal.
They are quantitatively, they will not agree.
They disagree, but you cannot just take one, the other, and declare that they are of the same quality. That's
correct.
This reminds a situation with experimental data, because the debate sometimes is we theorists tend to put our theory together with an experimental data here and there and say, the experimentalists don't agree, and that's a kind of error. But then they argue there are good experiments and bad experiments. Now, is there a way to in that case, I would say the two experimental groups have to get together, and one has to find the smoking gun.
That's not how they do it in experiments.
No?
What they do is they have a neutral body of people that evaluate.
Okay.
They decide what to keep and what not.
For a selected group of things.
So that's the spirit behind the flag now group,
yeah.
Right?
For the
participatable
data.
It's just for Masons,
but
I'm sure.
Now that there's
that much
data, they must be looking at
it.
You can
have
a four star or whatever.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So it's actually not crazy.
We've identified a good lunchtime discussion. Let's thank you for getting out.